Hello and welcome to episode 19 of the Poolside Pass podcast. On today's episode, I'm speaking with James Gibson, who is coach or head coach of Energy Standard Swimming out in Turkey, and also ISL 2019 champions. I'm going to be speaking to James about his transfer from being a swimmer into being an elite coach, and also what it's like to coach some of the fastest swimmers on the planet. So looking forward to catching up with James. Before we get into the main topic of the episode, just a quick line from our sponsors, Streamlined. Become a qualified swimming teacher with Streamlined in as little as 6 days. Learn at your own pace and be guided by our expert tutors. You can do your training face-to-face, online in real time, or a combination of the two. Assessment can be in your club using videos or attending one of our assessment venues. We offer tailored, high-quality support. Quote the Poolside Pass for an extra 10% discount. Okay, so I think it's about time I introduce James to the podcast. James Gibson, welcome to the Poolside Pass.
Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. So why don't we just start with a little bit of summary of your kind of background in the sport, how you crossed over into coaching from your time as a swimmer.
Okay, so I swam for Great Britain for 10 years from pretty much from 1999 through to 2009. In 2009, I did the World Championships in Rome. That was my last meet as a senior professional. Then got a back injury and then sort of transitioned to coaching, where I was currently based in Marseille in the south of France at the time. I transitioned to coaching there. I worked as like an assistant coach for a year, supporting the head coach, Romain Barnier. And then from 2011 onwards, I had my own kind of group that I was working with, but still within the framework of a club. When I was there at the time, in 2012, Marseille was made a French high performance centre. So I very quickly got into high performance coaching. I was very lucky. I think it was more of a case of being in the right place at the right time. There I was very fortunate to work with a great group of athletes. One of them, younger ones at the time, was called Florent Manadou. He was able to unexpectedly win the Olympics in London. I think at the French trials, he only qualified by 1/100th of a second. But he had some huge development that took place between April and August of 2012, which helped him dramatically, one would say. Then in 2012, I came back to England. I started off as the national sprint coach. Had my first experience of a restructure after about a week of being employed. Wasn't the most pleasant thing in the world. Then sort of the role in Britain changed at that point, because Britain lost its lottery funding, a lot of it, the funding through to Rio were from the results in London. There I was based with Kevin Renshaw in Loughborough, where I ran was part of the sprint. I ran kind of the sprint program out of there. After 2016, I moved over to a new project, that being Energy Standards. At the time, it was mainly a Russian-Ukrainian club, and I was tasked with sort of building the best swimming club in the world, giving it more of an international feel, and then trying to integrate it into an ongoing project, which is the International Swimming League, which has always been the sort of the big goal of Konstantin Grigoryshyn, who I work for.
So, obviously, this year, champions, or last 2019 champions of the ISL. Just briefly, just give us a little bit of an idea of what it was like to kind of go on that tour around the world of the ISL.
So the ISL, completely different. It's a completely different format to what we've seen in swimming. It requires a different style of coaching. You know, like when you coach on the ISL, you're not really doing anything what I would call traditional coaching. You're more just trying to get an athlete to the block. So, because it's so fast, the format is each minute and a half. So when one race finishes, a minute and a half after that, the next race goes. And the reason why it's so quick and the format is so condensed is it's purely for production and entertainment. The traditional model of swimming, it hasn't worked with spectators. We haven't seen swimmers generate huge livelihoods. There's not huge sponsorship involved. There's not huge TV money involved, except for around the Olympic Games. So what we tried to do with the ISL format is to create something spectator-friendly and build it on that. It's a different challenge for coaches, different challenge for athletes. It's fantastic, you know, working the recruitment strategy, working within budgeting, salary caps of athletes, exchanges of athletes, and being involved in those negotiations to go on a world tour. It's been something I've never done before, with especially with a huge group. Like, we were about 50 in total in Las Vegas, and that's a big group to manage, especially in a high performance level and a high performance scene. But it's been a huge learning curve, and I've loved every minute of it. And I'm looking forward to getting this season, the Solidarity Camp, moving forward. I'm looking forward to getting that moving as well.
So I think, as you mentioned, really, in when you were giving us your background, I think it's fair to say you've had majority of your career working with sprinters. Was this planned when you first crossed over into coaching, or has he just kind of happened upon it?
I think sprinting is something I'm definitely, you know, I was a sprinter myself. It's definitely something I'm quite comfortable with. It's quite comfortable. I'm quite comfortable coaching that. And when I was coming through my swimming sort of development, I always thought that the sprinters got a raw deal. And there was always a stigma attached to the sprinters for, you know, just because you don't swim up and down 6-7K a workout doesn't mean you're not professional. And you know what? So the sprinters I work with, like Ben Proud and Sarah Sjostrom, are probably some of the most professional athletes I've ever seen in the water. You know, I mean, I think we need to get rid of this terminology. Just because you don't swim up and down and swim like a distance swimmer doesn't mean you're not professional in what you're doing. And the sprinters did in yesteryear got a bit of a raw deal, like Mark Foster. Mark Foster was one of the first radical guys. You know, really took the low yardage, embraced the low yardage, and that's kind of so where I go with my, I thought with my coaching. You know, I've got a, I don't mind taking risks, and I always thought that we did too much work. And you know, with what I do with the sprint guys now, you know, what people would consider that to be not training sort of 10, 15 years ago, but it's specific to what they need and makes them go fast. And it's still very individual. Like I used to work with a guy called Camille Lacour in France, and it almost seemed like the lower the yardage he did, the worse he could sprint. So, you know, it's still individual for every athlete. Some sprinters need a bit more, some need to do next to nothing. But as long as the coach understands who they're working with and there's a good understanding and good fit, there's no reason why they can't put together a good program.
So your first experience coaching, kind of what we term as an elite sprinter, was that with Florent Manardi?
No, my first coaching. So when I was in France, I was working the first year, 2010. I was more of the, you know, an assistant, just learning the ropes, just helping out where I could, and working with Romain Barnier. He was the French national team coach up until Rio. He was the head coach of France. Yeah, I got to see it, learn a lot about also how to build a program, how to coach a program. How this to take away this notion of the coach owns the athlete. And I really learned there that, you know, the athlete's good. The coach is only as good as the athlete. And a lot of people seem to think it's the other way around, but I can trust you, it's not. If you've got a good athlete, they're good because they're good. I worked with Romy for a year, and then there was a job come up, like a full-time job at the start of the start of the 2011 season. So I took that. I was working full-time as a more of the sprint-based coach, even right from the start. And I had a young girl called Inga Decker in my group. She won the world championships in the 50 fly in 2011. So my group was only small. I had Inga, Florent Manardi, and a few others. So I was lucky because we were made like a French performance centre really when I sort of took that role. And it was more, like I said, it was the right place, right time. So I could work with a small group. I didn't have to have 30, 40 kids. And I know now I'm very lucky that I had that experience. So Ingo won the world championships in 11. Flo come through, like he came through hugely in 2012, but still wasn't spectacular pretty much until he dived in for his Olympic final.
So what would you say from having that kind of that small group you had right at the very start there, what would you say you learned from that that you took with you when you moved back to Britain and now on now to Energy Standard?
Well, as a coach, you learn from the athletes. I know we all do professional learning, we do professional development, but the most you learn is from your athletes, absolutely. And I was privileged right from the word go that, Inga was an Olympic champion from 2008 in the women's relay. She was a European champion, a world short course champion. So, you're working with people with huge experience. And I learned a lot from the athletes I was working with because they were already quite good, and they'd already kind of got their strokes in place. They were all technically very solid to start with. And working with that small group, and they're all different personalities. And I thought, you have to individualize your program. So I individualized. What Inga and Florent needed were two totally different things. So I didn't mind treating people differently. I know some cultures and clubs, it's treat everyone the same, get the same development, but I don't believe in that. I believe that, especially at the elite end, the individuals have to be treated, differently because they all work differently. And they all also come from different backgrounds. So my team in Energy Standard now, I've got guys who've grown up in Eastern Ukraine. I've got guys that grow up in Western Europe. And they've had very different developments. And they all see the world very differently. So as a coach, you have to adapt yourself as well. It's not just someone comes to your program and they toe the line. Because if you've got a good swimmer, you have to adapt yourself to understand their philosophies as well.
Absolutely. So when you're at the start of the season, or even before that, when you've got a sprinter and you want to take them on to deliver a great performance at the end of the season, how do you go about kind of planning your season? What types of work would you emphasize at different points in the season? Because of, like you've already said, sprinters are different to normal swimmers. They need different things at different times. So what would you say you like to emphasize at different points in the season?
Which is, again, it depends on the individual. So like you can find a sprinter that can deal with a serious training load and they need that to swim fast, and you can find others that can't deal with any load at all and they need that. But generally I do a reverse periodization model with all of my sort of sprinters, and when we start the season, it's an appreciation that they don't have that, their speed's not in place, they're at huge injury risk. So I can actually say what I'm going to do pretty much after this COVID break, a very slow build up, dry land wise, make sure all techniques in place, probably one swim session a day for the first 2 to 3 weeks, just so we don't overkill. There's going to be a big push after this. There's going to be a lot of athletes stressed and they're going to try and push too hard too soon. And that's going to cause more problems than what it will deliver solutions. Because it seems like Britain seems to be one of the only countries at the minute where the elite athletes can't get in the water, Britain and the USA. So there's this feeling of we've got to catch up, which I don't believe is the case whatsoever, especially in the sprint events. So we'll do a nice, slow, steady build-up, but we won't train speed from the word go. I'll work technique. I'll work just injury prevention stuff. And then when I feel like they're ready, I'll start with overspeed work, fins, paddles, swimming above race pace, assisted cords, like the reverse periodization, give the speed when it's safe to go. So it's kind of like after 2 or 3 weeks, start to really develop the overspeed. And then I'll slowly take that equipment away as we go through the cycle.
Cool. So, and then as you get towards that kind of key benchmark meet, I know obviously taper is a complex and individual process. But what do you consider when you're planning that taper for those sprinters?
I think honestly, I think taper is a psychological process. Mm-hmm. Some sprinters don't need hardly any taper at all. Like, I'll give you an example. Sarah, last year in 2019, she spent 2 weeks or 3 weeks in Gloria with me, swimming 50, 55K a week because we were going to have a good go at the 200 freestyle at the World Championships. She flew home, and 2 days later, she was dead tired. 2 days later, went 23.6, almost broke the world record in the 50. So it's so individual for everyone. Ben Proud lifts weights all the way through his taper. If he feels like he doesn't lift, he feels like he loses this elasticity and his fire, and it's a feel thing. He likes to lift weights to feel a bit of tension, where Florent Manadou likes a good rest because he's got these huge floppy muscles, so he needs a rest. But that comes with knowing your athlete and knowing their body type. And you can tell who they are. The ones that swim well in season are generally the ones that can recover very, very quickly, and they don't need as much rest as the others. But what I would do is I always back off, because I do believe taper is a psychological process. And obviously, when you back off, the athletes feel fresher. You can give them a couple of lay-ins in the morning. And it's a general feeling of, I feel good, yeah. kind of thing. But there, like I said, I do reduce yardage. For a lot of them, there's not really much yardage to drop off. So some of them, I'm a little bit more careful with. But again, I try to sit down. I explain to the guys, like, I'll sit down with Sarah or Ben, so that we need to be at this level because this is what's going to make you swim fast. As long as the athlete understands, and you have that buy-in, that's the most important thing, to be honest.
Yeah. So,
for an example, if you have an athlete that craves taper, he's desperate for taper, and 100% believes that they need a good rest to swim fast, but then the science is pointing otherwise, is, you know, I always go with the emotional state because I think the mind is more powerful. And you've got it, or you meet halfway on things.
It almost prevents that kind of self-fulfilling prophecy where they believe if they haven't had a taper, they won't swim well. So then it won't happen.
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, I think, you know, with athletes, I always listen to my athletes, always listen to them. But again, I'm in a very privileged position. I'm in an exceptionally privileged position, and I know I'm lucky with the athletes I work with. You know, that a lot of them are past that education phase. Yeah. Although we're still learning, and although we're still trying to find ways to get better, that like I said, their philosophies are still pretty much set.
Yeah. So I noticed when you were talking about how you plan your season, you spoke about making sure the technique's right, quite a bit of technical work kind of early on in your process. You share a lot on social media. I think you're probably one of the best coaches in terms of your Instagram. You share a lot of videos of your swimmers working on technical things, which I like to look at. Can you explain kind of your process that you go around kind of refining and making a few technical changes?
No, absolutely. You know, one thing I learned over time is in the coaching is you got to do the basics. And do the basics very, very well. Don't skirt over the basics. Like I've seen a lot of people, they do technique and it's not really engaged work. You know, it's just, you just go and you swim. I've come in, also a lot of people criticize me for the amount of fins I use with technique, but everyone's individual. And that's just my model. It doesn't mean it's right or it's wrong. It's just the way I prefer to do things. And I work a lot on just setting the stroke up, because efficiency, honestly, it always wins over raw power, always. And you know, the guys that are exceptionally powerful, you know, you can train as hard as you like, but if you're not working your technique and be trying to come as efficient as possible, you're never ever going to get to be on the Olympic podium. I think, you know, with poor technique, you can get you a long way if you're exceptionally talented. But I mean, to really step on the top step of the podium, you've got to be very technically proficient. And I spend a lot of time, even with the guys, you know, it's just repetition of excellence, I'd call it. And you've got to find different ways to set it up, whether it's a stretch cord, whether it's over slow movements, trying to just reinforce good patterns. And as long as, as long as it's well communicated with the athletes, it's well received. They need video feedback constant. Like, this is my favorite tool, my iPhone.
Yeah.
You know, that you can, it's immediate. It's there. I use an iPad as well. And they like it. And the athlete, like, especially, you know, I'll give you an example. Flo loves to see how he swims. Flo has this gift. And also I've seen it in someone, and Chad Leclos and James Guy. James Guy has it as well. They can watch a video of anyone and replicate it. You know, they can swim like Michael Phelps. They can do this loping technique on freestyle just for games. You know, they've got this aquatic intelligence. So yeah, technique at the start of the season, set it up. Nothing radical, no major changes. I'd say with any new athletes, I made mistakes in the past, like any coach. You get a new athlete and you're like, you want to fix them straight away. I mean, do this, do that. It's just the nature of a coach. And I've realized over time that this is a monumental failure on many levels, because you're changing their daily training environment. Many of them leave their homes for the first time. They're changing their way of training. We might be doing more dry land. And then you take away their technique, which feels natural to them. It might be rot, might not be the best technique in the world, but it feels natural for that athlete. So if you take that away, they lose their feeling. And then what you end up is an absolute mess. So now if I take any new athletes, I don't touch their technique really for a good 6 months until they're fully adapted into the program.
Yeah, I think that's good. I think I've not often thought of it that way, but yeah. Into your program, and they change pretty much the whole way of life. And then you try and take their technique away and change that, and before you know it, they literally feel like they're lost, and everything's different. So they need something to kind of hold on to that they know is the same.
No, absolutely. And I've made that mistake. You know, I'm happy to tell you I've made that mistake, because as a coach, you're like, you look at something and you're like, I can fix it. I want to do it. And it's difficult to stop yourself, because that's our job. But just my experience, and hey, other people might have had much more positive experiences. But for me, it generally, unless you're working with a top talent, is very difficult for that to work all the time. It's not, and it's just the coach just being eager to help. That's all it is.
So you spoke there about often, like, efficiency always wins. Efficiency will always win. I think when I look at my high coach at the age group level, often you see swimmers who are, and it's because of the way growth and development works, you see swimmers that are just big and powerful often tend to win over those swimmers that are slightly smaller but far more skillful. How important is being technically proficient and technically really skillful to being able to compete at the top level?
Hey, that's such a hard one, eh? That's such a difficult one for age group coaches. And I've been asked that before, because in Marseille, we had an age group program, and it was, you know, like, if the big kid is winning easily, it's hard to tell them to do anything different, because they're winning. So their psyche is, there's nothing wrong with what I'm doing. We all know that it has a ceiling. It will have a plateau at some point. Whether that boy or girl gets to the Olympic final, you know, that technique might be sufficient. But I'd say always, you know, it's just honing in. An athlete will. It doesn't matter their level of ability. If they can perfect their movements, if they can pop their elbows, if they're dropping their elbows on freestyle, fly, and backstroke in the propulsive phases, you know that they're going to carry that all the way through their career. So, you know, it's good to work on it as a junior. And then just, you know, honing in over and over and over and over, because then when they get to the top level, everything is easy. There's a leveling out phase as well in the junior swimming. You know, the big kid suddenly becomes the average size kid, and everyone becomes a very similar level. Like I say, unless you have a very, very extreme talent. I think Ian Thorpe was world champion at 15. Michael Phelps was world champion very, very young. So, but traditionally, you know, it will all even out at some point, and then the swimmers with who are the most efficient will take over.
Absolutely. I just wanted to get that in there, because I know we have like a few swimmers perhaps listen to this. So just kind of for those swimmers that might feel a bit lost, they're getting beaten out all the time or whatever, just thought that'd be a useful message to get out there from someone that's worked with that.
And I'd say as well, set yourself goals. Like a swimming race is a race. You want to win. You want to do a PB. That's how it is. But always set yourself other goals. So if you know you might not win, maybe why don't you set yourself a goal of, I want to come do my last 25 in this number of strokes. I want to swap to straight arm in the last five. I'm not going to breathe in the last five. I want to have a good... I'm not going to breathe in and out of my turns. You know, set yourself achievable goals. So after the race, maybe if you haven't won, you still feel like you've got better.
Yeah.
Because I think there's too many times, like, this is where ISL is quite good, that we're trying to take out some of the time focus and make it more about winning. A lot of swimmers are upset. You know, let's say it's not right or wrong, but swimmers like to swim fast and do PBs all the time. It's almost impossible to do a PB every race. It is, even if you're the best swimmer in the world. So I'd say always have attainable targets, and that talk through with the coach. Like, and you know, if the swimmer goes to the coach and says, oh, you know, give me something that I want to do in the race to practice getting better, and then the coach and the swimmer will always help, always find something.
Absolutely. So you spoke there about the ISL and how about. Helps by taking time out of things. Just another thing on the ISL, especially with it happening this season happened within kind of the early part of the season. So traditionally for swimming coaches, that's the part of the season where you might not compete as much. You might be doing a lot more kind of larger volume training. How did you kind of approach that? Because it's now a period where perhaps they're racing a little bit more frequently and you need to be able to race well through that.
You just say what I did with my guys was I think, you know, you've got to look at the whole model of swimming. It is changing. FINA Champion Series, ISL is going to be in the idea this year was 27 matches after the Olympics, Worlds. There's a lot more commercial opportunities for the athletes, so you know that. Like traditional training methods, yeah, big volume through this period, for the winter period, then moving more to anaerobic work. I think that everyone's going to have to rethink sooner or later. If we're going to try and stick with the traditional method, I think it's not going to work, especially because the athletes are going to want to swim in these meets. They're going to want to earn more money. And we take someone like Katinka. So I've been working a little bit with Katinka. She works hard through the majority of the races that she does. She knows she's going to swim well at the Worlds and the Olympics because she'll do a full taper. But she'll work hard and she'll do her extra volume or whatever. She'll just take a couple of days rest leading into these meets and she'll be okay. I think the thing is now is the athletes are going to go more down this road. They'll train hard, a couple of days rest, into the meets, but they'll still have their cycles around performing, whether it be an ISL grand final, peaking there, peaking at the Olympics, peaking at the Worlds. There'll still be like cycles within the training, but it won't be, you know, if you're going to a competition, if it's the Essex County Championships or Southern Counties or Midlands, you'll tend to train right through that. But if you can go to an ISL meet and walk away with $20,000, $30,000, you're going to adjust your thinking a little bit.
Absolutely, yeah. So part of the ISL, and I think part of the reasons, when I was speaking to Tom Rushton, part of the reasons you guys did so well is that you really kind of nailed the skins. Mm-hmm. The skins are such an important part of that process at the ISL. It's a series of sprint events with a relatively short kind of turnaround time between them. How did you approach that in terms of preparation with the athletes, because it can be quite difficult physiologically to be able to produce that?
Yeah, poor old Benny. Poor old Benny Proud. he did a fabulous job for us. Ben's job was always to just to try and get in the final. So he knew he had to do two all-out 50s and then he'd be all right. But no, with the Skins, with all the points in the ISL, like, it was pretty clear for me and Tom. Like, we read the rules. We knew how we could win the meets. We'd win the meets through the relays and the Skins, which are the double and the triple points, to prepare. There was nothing special, no special preparation for the Skins. Didn't really change too much. I'm a firm believer of, as a coach, when the athlete is swimming fast, they're swimming fast. Doesn't matter what event they're doing. So Ben at the Commonwealth Games, I wouldn't consider Ben a 100 meter sprinter, but he still went 47 in the relay at the Commonwealth Games in 2018. You know, because he was on good form. So when you're on form, you're on form. You can swim well in most events. Within reason. Like, yeah. Ben would never go to 200 or 400. So with the Skins, no real special preparation for them. Just try and make the guys as quick as possible, because you've got to get out the first round. If you're not out of the first round, then you really suffer with the points. And that's what won us to meet in Las Vegas. Like, we shouldn't have won in Las Vegas. We didn't have the best team. We had the third best team on paper. And then it was just that on that last round of Skins, we got two guys through into the final four, and London didn't get anyone through. And I think that ultimately cost them the win. I also rested my Skins guys in the relays just before, where the other teams didn't do that, because I knew that the importance of what was going to come later on.
So you almost planned for having the maximum impact on that event where it was kind of triple points.
Yeah, and we won three of the ISL meets all on the last race. That come down all onto the last, like, the male Skins. But then we knew that was always the plan. It wasn't anything radical. That was the only way we could do it. We weren't going to win on individual race performances. We weren't as strong as Cali Condors. We weren't as strong as London. But so I was able to manipulate the strategy just to make sure. Tom was superb. He had it all planned out on his Excel spreadsheet, where we should be, where the points should be, and he'd almost done the virtual meets before we'd gone there.
so just to finish off the podcast, we always ask coaches to kind of give us their top three tips for a specific topic. And I just want to hear today if you've got any top three tips for kind of working with sprinters. So if you've got something to add to that.
I have one tip. That's it. One tip. Be as basic as you can possibly be. That's it. No games, no gimmicks. Look, we all like a bit of team building, but it's organized fun. I don't generally do a lot of that. A lot of people, when they come to visit our program, they're expecting to see radical new things, all singing, all dancing stuff. And no, I changed my way I do things now. I used to be always looking for different things and the next best gadget or gimmick, but it's to do the basics, but do them better than anyone else. Basics in technique, technical work, basic physiology, just done exceptionally well. We do basic land work. We don't, you know, in the gym, if you see Florent Manna do his 110 kilos, he can bench 150 quite easily. Ben Proud, that, you know, they're all strong guys, but they don't, it's not all singing or dancing strength program. It's a very, very well thought out by Marco Cosso, who's the strength coach. He uses science and data, but no radical movements. We got rid of all the radical circuit training, where you just watch all the horrendous technique that everyone is doing. They're actually damaging their long-term development in the pool. We swapped all this for Pilates and yoga work, functional movement, injury prevention. And I'd say our program is basic. There's nothing like fun and games, risky stuff. So every now and then we have a little bit of fun, but everything is just try and do the basics. Injury prevention, technique, physiology, gym, land work. Do it better than anyone else, and the swimmers will go fast.
I think that's a really good message. I think sometimes now, and especially in today's world, people try and maybe overcomplicate things, but keeping it basic, keeping it simple is a really, really key message for coaches.
And honestly, if I was to give Ben and Pernil and Flo these huge circuit trainings that I see in some of the Americans, they'd just break. They're Formula One cars. They go very, very fast, but they're fragile.
Yeah.
And you can, as a coach, you can make people worse. You know, there's this belief that, you know, coach, we could help everyone get better, better, better. But if we get it wrong, we make them worse.
Absolutely.
So what we try, honestly, we just try and do, like in the gym, it's basic bench press, pull up, bench pull. It's done in a safe environment with good technique. If you cannot do the technique, if you haven't had a good Olympic lift development, you don't do it, because the risk of injury is far, far excessive. I work with fantastic nutritionists first session I had with him, I don't mind saying this, was working with Fran Housel at the time, and she had a lot of supplements. He just put them all in a bin bag and said, we don't need any of these. We don't know what they're doing. Maybe we just start off with the basics. And then, you know, eat well. Eat well. You don't need to replace your meals with protein shakes and everything. You eat a balanced diet, you're fine.
Yeah.
And like I said, most of my guys, well, a lot of them don't even take supplements. And they're some of the best swimmers in the world. Some do, some don't. That's their individual choice, but that's done through batch testing and everything. But don't try and reinvent the wheel. Just try and do things as good as possible.
Excellent. James, thank you very much for your time. Wish you all the best in the upcoming Olympic season of 2020-2021, which now is. Listeners, thank you very much for tuning in again. I hope you found the episode useful. I certainly learned a lot from James today. I want to take this opportunity to point you towards our website, www.thepoolsidepass.com. And of course, we're on social media, Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, all at The Poolside Pass. Till next time, keep learning. Take care.